Okay, well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here, and while the, oh, it's already up there. I forgot to have a slide that says that I have nothing to disclose. The only people that I am indebted to are the American public as a long-term government employee. So what I'd like to do today is kind of give you a whirlwind tour of what we know about dioxins and its effects in people. And I'm going to start that actually by talking about what we know about its effect in a lot of other animal species, because I always remind people that we are animals. And in fact, when you, dioxin is kind of a, likes to do lots of things in lots of different vertebrate species. And it's hard for me to believe that humans would be an exception. Okay, let's see, it's not, okay. So why are we interested in dioxins? And this is just kind of a little bit of a journey through the last 100 or so years of our concern about dioxin. It started when chloracne was first characterized. I'm gonna show you a picture of someone with chloracne later. With the production of PCBs in the last century, PCBs were produced. They were intentionally made. They were marvelous industrial products. But then we began to see a number of poisonings that occurred. There was X disease in cattle, which again was kind of a terrible skin disease, and the animals wasted. Nitro West Virginia was an explosion of a plant in the Kanawha Valley, and we had many people who developed chloracne at that plant, and there's a whole host of things, but in this session, a lot of the focus is on the use of Agent Orange in Southeast Asia from 62 to 70, and I think one point that needs to be made very clearly is dioxin is not Agent Orange. It was an unwanted contaminant of Agent Orange. Agent Orange was a mixture of approximately equal parts of 2,4-5-D, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, which were two herbicides, and unfortunately, in the production, there was dioxin 2,3-7-A-TCDD was also produced. There were many other herbicide preparations that were used during the Vietnam experience. Some of them had no dioxin in them, but many of them had significant amounts of dioxin that was used. And then there have been another number of other episodes that have occurred. So some of you may remember Times Beach, which was a town in Missouri where waste oil was spread on a horse rink and ended up contaminating the entire town. The town actually was evacuated. I think one of the landmark studies was NIOSH did a cancer mortality study of U.S. workers that was released in 1991, and it was the first study in which there was actual measurements done of at least a subset of the cohort showing how much dioxin was in the people. So it was the first one where there was a clear ability to associate an exposure with the response. And then there was, for example, there have been a number of poisonings that have occurred intentionally or unintentionally over the past years. So just as a scientist, I occasionally have to show a little bit. This is just what the structure of dioxin, it's often called the most toxic man-made chemical. And one of the important things is it's just a representative of a class. It may be the most toxic representative, but there are other compounds that do exactly the same thing. You just might need a little bit more of it. All of the chemicals have a common mechanism of action, and I'll show you one slide about. They all have a common spectrum of biological effects that they cause, and the problem with them is that they don't go away. So that not only are they very potent, but that they are very persistent both in the environment and in the human body, as well as the body of lots of animals. Another point is I've talked about these other related chemicals. Dioxin is never found alone. Even in Agent Orange, we talk about TCDD, but there was small amounts of other dioxin-related compounds there. And that formed the basis for an approach which is known as the toxic equivalency approach, which is basically just a weighted average, so that when you're trying to understand the effects that you're looking at, you're not just looking maybe at 2,3,7-A-TCDD. You're looking at the total toxic potential of the entire mixture. So as I've said, dioxin is representative, and here are some of the other chemicals that fall into this classes. The dioxins, as I said, they were TCDD was a contaminant of Agent Orange. All the dioxins and all the polyhalogenated dibenzofurans were never intentionally produced. I mean, a little bit has been made in analytical labs so that you would have a chemical standard, but they were never industrial chemicals. They were unwanted byproducts of certain industrial processes, especially certain kinds of industrial combustions. So certain of the herbicides, which were banned 20 and 30 years ago, were contaminated. Also something like hexachlorophene, some of you may remember that, it used to be part of Physohex, was contaminated, was no longer made. Bleaching of paper and pulp products with chlorine led to elevated levels of certain of the dioxins. Again, those processes are no longer used. Now, in addition to the dioxins, the new furans, and I explicitly say polyhalogenated here because TCDD has chlorine in it. But in fact, we are now beginning to find, especially in China, where there's a lot of uncontrolled recycling that's going on, we're finding the brominated compounds. So we're finding them not only in the soil and in the fish, but we're finding them in people. So we have tetrabromodibenzodioxin, which is as potent, for example, as the chlorinated version. We also have some of the PCBs and some of the naphthalenes and the azoxybenzenes. The point is, and actually, let's see if I can go back one slide. If you look at that, if you've got this big, flat, planar molecule, and you've got the halogens, those are the green atoms sticking out on the side, you need a structure like that to be persistent and to cause this spectrum of responses. Okay. So I mentioned the problem with dioxin is that it doesn't go away. It's extremely persistent. Its half-life in the environment is estimated to be about 30 years. Its half-life in people is, depending upon how heavy you are, may be anywhere from 5 to 10 or 12 or even 15 years. The heavier you are, the longer it will stay with you. So again, they were generated for the Vietnam conflict in terms of chlorinated herbicide production as a unwanted byproduct. Most of the exposure, at least of our military, was from herbicide handling and application. It was in their examples of dioxin entered human and natural environments, for example. And there still continues to be some follow-up of the ranch hand study, which has been provides a wealth of information, and hopefully we're actually going to be able to initiate some additional studies on that cohort, which were brought to at least temporary completion during the last administration. So what are some of the effects that dioxin causes? Well, there's a plethora of responses, loads of effects on wildlife and domestic animals. For example, the trout in Lake Ontario ceased to reproduce, and you have no natural trout there because of the effects. So we've seen effects in fish, birds, mammals. We've seen effects, for example, in the Baltic, which is very highly contaminated, with seals and dolphins. We see developmental and reproductive and immunological effects at environmental levels in wildlife. We've also seen effects on domestic animals, and these have usually been unintentional poisoning episodes. So effects have been seen in cows, horses, sheep, and chickens. And in laboratory animals, every class in the vertebrate phyla has been impacted by dioxin. So there have been multiple studies done with lots of different kinds of fish, different amphibians, turtles. Nobody I know has done anything with crocodiles or snakes yet, but a lot of different bird species have been looked at. You know, when people talk about laboratory animals, they tend to see rats and mice, maybe guinea pigs, but there's also a lot of stuff has been observed in hamsters, rabbits, dogs, and in several species of non-human primates. So again, we have a contaminant that does lots of things, and here's a kind of a laundry list, and again, you're not supposed to memorize the list in any way, shape, or form, but just get an idea of the wide variety of impacts that dioxin can cause. So it can alter your metabolism, it can alter the ability of cells to divide and to grow and divide. It can modulate lots of different hormones and receptors. I often say I never met an endocrine system that dioxin didn't like to perturb. On the toxic side, at the high dose, and high is a relative term because you're a guinea pig, you might only need a microgram per kilogram, which is a tiny amount. If you're a hamster, you might need a milligram per kilogram, but you're still, if you get that kind of dose, you're going to undergo a wasting, lose up to half of your body weight, and eventually die. So some of these are kind of an order of how high the dose had to be. But when you go down to relatively low doses, we can in fact see things like cardiovascular toxicity, effects on the teeth, neurotoxicity, effects on the immune system occur at very, very low levels of exposure. Dioxin is a known animal and human carcinogen in multiple species and in multiple sites. And some of the things I'm going to come back to is the developing organism appears to be exquisitely sensitive. It's a window of susceptibility to the effects of dioxin. And early life exposure can perturb multiple systems of the body. So this is just a slide that I'd actually put together when I was at EPA a number of years ago, which looks at how much of the dioxin is in an animal and how does that compare to the average amount in a human being. And in the US, the average person has what we call a body burden, which is in your entire body, you have about 5 nanograms per kilogram of body weight. So we could calculate this up if the average, we used to say the average man in the US was 70 kilograms. That's not true anymore. It'd be a lot higher than that. But we're also looking here in the column on your left, we're looking at the issue about the ratio between where do we see effects in animals and where do we see effects in people. And the point is that there's not much of an exposure difference here. So if you look at something like developmental neurotoxicity, you need 4 times the body burden in our animal models as compared to what's currently in people. Now remember, that's an average, that's what's in people. So there are some people that are double or triple that average. People from the general population, people for whom we have no known reason why they are more highly exposed. And you can see that certain of the effects, for example, like the developmental reproductive effects, in fact, we may already have some people in the population who there's no margin of exposure at all, and I'm going to come back to that point later. So again, the important things about dioxin is that you have multiple effects in multiple tissues, in both males and females, in multiple species throughout the vertebrate phylum. And in addition, we have changes occurring at all levels of biological organization, from the molecular level all the way up to the tissue organ level, affecting growth and differentiation, and ultimately can be associated with wasting and death. So this is the only really highly technical slide I'm going to show you. But the point is that all of the effects of dioxin require interaction with this protein known as the AH receptor. And the AH receptor is turning out to be fascinating because we're beginning to understand that this protein, it's kind of functions like a hormone receptor, but it functions not only in the nucleus of the cell, but also functions in the cytoplasm of the cell. It not only acts to regulate directly the expression of certain genes, but it also regulates in the cytoplasm the action of multiple protein kinases and phosphatases. All these things play key roles in cell growth and development. So we're now beginning to understand that the AH receptor, in fact, is a tumor suppressor in certain tissues. It acts like an oncogene in other tissues. These are very important things in terms of cancer. It is absolutely essential for normal development. If you make animals where you've knocked out that receptor, they have much reduced fertility. They age much too early. That for rodents, they undergo a lot of problems in their liver and in their immune system and in their cardiovascular system. And if you make the AH receptor be on all the time, which is kind of what happens when dioxin is bound to it because dioxin is so persistent, you also get tumors in multiple sites, you get developmental problems, reproductive problems, neurological problems. I could go on with the list. So the important thing here, again, is that it interacts with key regulatory molecules in the cell, and dioxin is blocking or interfering with that regulation. So I kind of gave you a little bit of a heads up when I said, you know, nearly all vertebrates respond to dioxin, so what about people? And I said people are animals. We have this AH receptor, and it functions in us just the way it does in multiple animal species. We know that if you take human cells and you culture them, or certain human organs that you can culture, you get the same response. In fact, usually at a similar concentration that you do to cells from rats or mice or guinea pigs or non-human primates, for example. We can actually measure biochemical changes in people who've been exposed. We can see some subtle effects in the general population, and we have clearly seen adverse effects, and I'm going to show you a picture, in a highly exposed populations. So the question that I would say, it's not, can people respond? The answer is absolutely. The question is, well, how much do you have in order to see responses? So some of you may remember Viktor Yushchenko, who was the premier of Ukraine, and shortly before his election, he was intentionally poisoned, he believes, at a dinner with the Russians. We're not sure how he was poisoned. Most of us believe that it was put into his soup. We estimate that he was probably given about 25 micrograms. About 2 milligrams. Now, 2 milligrams to a man who probably at the time was, say, 80 kilograms or so is a very, very, very tiny dose. It's certainly a dose that it would have killed a guinea pig, but in no way would it have killed, say, a mouse. But what the picture shows the before and after, and he is showing you a classic example of chloracne, which is a horrendous kind of acne, not limited to the face. It's all over the body. Some of the workers who were exposed at the explosion in Nitro, West Virginia in 1949, some of those who are still alive still have chloracne. It's a very persistent and essentially untreatable condition. So this is often called the hallmark of dioxin toxicity, because if you get chloracne, you had to have been exposed to a dioxin-like chemical. It could have been a PCB. It could have been something else, but it had to have a dioxin-like chemical that activated this AH receptor to cause these effects. We know that some people are more susceptible than others. We know that young children may be more susceptible than older folks, for example. We've seen it not only in people, but for example in non-human primates. We've seen it in cows and rats and certain strains of mice who have an inherent genetic susceptibility to it. And the chloracne is associated, if there's developmental exposure, not just with the skin changes, but it also problems with the development of the teeth and the hair and the nails. And there were several poisonings in the Far East, one in Taiwan and one in Japan, in which children were exposed in utero, unfortunately, to a mixture of rice oil, which had been contaminated with some PCBs and the polychlorinated dibenzofurans. And these children were called Coca-Cola babies because of the chloracne kind of response and the effect with their teeth, hair, and nails. So what about the health effects in the highly exposed populations? Well, first of all, exposures aren't as high as we once thought. Ambient exposure is about maybe 1/10 to 1/100th of where some of the effects have been reported. There have been a number of occupational populations in which we've seen chloracne, cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. And then with some of the unplanned, unwanted poisoning episodes, like the two in the Far East or the one in Seveso, which was where a trichlorophenol plant exploded outside of Milan in 1976 and sprayed about 60 kilograms of trichlorophenol that was contaminated with dioxin, with 2,3,7,8 TCDD in that area. And that population continues to be followed. And for epidemiology studies, we're learning a great deal about the human health effects, where we can clearly see not only chloracne and cancer, but heart disease, type 2 diabetes, reproductive effects, developmental effects, hormonal and immune effects in that population. So again, laundry list of the effects that occur in people. There's a vast number that have been reported. I'll come back a little bit to cardiovascular disease. This was recently, the Institute of Medicine recently also agreed that cardiovascular disease was associated with dioxin exposure. 2 years earlier, they had decided that diabetes was associated. We know there are multiple cancers. porphyria has been reported in case studies. There are a number of other things, effects on, for example, endometriosis, early menopause. I should have put up here the recent studies, reduced fertility in women who are exposed as young children, effects on multiple hormone systems, decreases in testosterone and thyroid, just a whole host of things. Developmental, again, is a key window. Effects on multiple systems, the thyroid system, the immune system, neurobehavioral changes, including cognition and psychomotor effects, effects on the teeth, and effects, for example, on the number of boys, girls being shifted, more girls being born than boys to people who had been exposed, and effects on breast development. So again, some of the specific developmental reproductive effects in humans, we've seen changes in the sex ratio. This was first clearly seen in the Seveso population, where the normal sex ratio is about 104 boys born for every 100 girls, and this switched to about 90 boys born for every 100 girls, which was a tremendous difference. The boys from the Asian cohorts have been reported to have penises that are too small when they reach puberty, changes in sperm number and motility and function, increases in endometriosis, some changes in the teeth, and changes in breast development. And these all of these effects have been modeled by results from animal studies. So there have been a number of studies in children who are exposed prenatally and also lactationally in some cases. There have been several ongoing cohorts that continue to be studied in Michigan, North Carolina, and upstate New York. I should mention there have also been a lot of studies producing a lot of information from the Inuit in northern Quebec. There are studies that have been followed populations in Japan, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Finland. And what has been shown in these populations are low birth weight, cognitive and behavioral impairments, effects on the immune system, effects on hormones, especially the thyroid effects, and again, changes in teeth. Now, there are a number of recent, relatively recent effects that have been reported in the epidemiology literature. I mentioned the IOM update of 2008, and I believe that they just met to work on the IOM 2010 update about a week or two ago in Washington. But these are cumulative reviews. So that once they decide, for example, that there's sufficient evidence of something, for example, the soft tissue sarcoma, that won't be removed from the list unless there's evidence that would argue against it at that point. So there have been certain conditions or diseases that have gone onto the list and then come off, and other things that were added. So in 2008, for example, the important things that were really added was the Parkinson's disease was added for limited association, and ischemic heart disease were the new things that were added at that time. But in again, clear evidence of, for example, the chloracne, several kinds of cancer, limited evidence of some other kinds of cancers, some peripheral neuropathy. The hypertension obviously goes along frequently with the ischemic heart disease, and no evidence of spontaneous abortion after parental exposure to TCDD. So the Seveso, which is the population in Italy I mentioned, continues to be studied. There's a Seveso Women's Reproductive Health Study, which is an ongoing study where they're focusing on women who are exposed between the ages of zero up till about the age of 40 in 1976. So we're just beginning to be able to look at second generation effects now, what may be happening to the children of these women or these men and the studies. In addition, there have been a lot of ecological studies that have been done looking at the different regions in Seveso. There were some areas that there was higher, more of deposition from the explosion in Zone A. So people in that region, at least the average exposure was higher than Zone B, than was higher than in the unexposed region. But I can tell you that the ecological studies have a great deal of problems because when they've actually measured blood levels, they find some people in the unexposed zone who have higher levels than some of the people in the most highly exposed zone. So it's really important that you have these internal measures of exposure. And the problem with dioxin also is what helps our study is that since it doesn't, or it very slowly goes away, what people were exposed to. If they were highly exposed in 1976 or in 1966, if they're some of our veterans, they still have levels that would be elevated compared to the general population today. But what's been seen in Seveso recently are the altered sex ratios are due to exposure of the father before the age of 18. So it's clearly in men who are young or boys at the time of the exposure. And this is indicated by, for example, changes in some of their hormone levels. In the female, there's growing evidence, not only from the Seveso studies, but from some of the other cohorts and from the animal studies. And this is typical of hormones or chemicals which interfere with hormone signaling, that you can have very different effects occur in different tissues. So, I mean, to give you another example you may be more familiar with, tamoxifen is used as a very good anti-breast cancer agent in women who have are estrogen receptor positive, but the same anti-estrogenicity that tamoxifen shows in the breast, it acts like an estrogen in the liver or the uterus. So, you know, the same thing with dioxin, it can block estrogen action in one tissue and another tissue actually enhance estrogen action. I mentioned the decrease in fertility that has been shown with dioxin, and a clear increase in breast cancer was shown in the Seveso population. We've also seen some increase in cardiovascular diseases in that population and increases in lymphatic and hematopoietic cancers. And then there's been some other populations from Asia that I mentioned. Yucheng is the cohort in Taiwan. Yusho is in Japan. But clear evidence of an increased diabetes incidence in women. This is a biochemical change which helps control where the dioxin is in your body. In Yusho, it's clear that it was the dioxin-like chemicals, not the PCBs, that caused basically the chloracne response in the children, and there were pregnancy complications in the first decade following the exposure. So the dioxin effects of the greatest concern, I would argue, are developmental, and some of these effects occurred at the high end of the background population. All the cohorts I mentioned before, the three US cohorts, the Dutch cohort, and some, these are all general population cohorts. There were the cognitive effects, the decreased optimality in IQ, changes in behavior, the immune system, hormone system, and growth. So human exposure, where are we? Well, in general, at least 95% of our exposure or more comes from our consumption of animal products, especially fatty animal products. So I often remind people that the public health recommendation is to eat a healthy heart diet, which is a more balanced diet with less animal fats, for example. There might be some inhalation or dermal exposure that from occupational or accidental exposures. Really, there is very little new dioxin being generated today. I think this is a success of the regulatory agenda. The major sources have been controlled. The problem is re-entrainment of what we've already got out there in the environment. The current levels in the population are about, as I said before, 5 nanograms TEQ per kilogram. I should mention that's AIDS-related because of the very long half-life of the dioxins. The older you are, it's built up in your body, as well as the fact that exposures were much higher in the 60s and 70s than they are today. Exposure today is about less than 1% of what it was at that time. So again, potentially highly exposed populations may have higher levels, so nursing infants may have higher levels because dioxin is eliminated through the breast milk, and possibly subsistence farmers and fishers. So the key to the epidemiology studies on dioxin is that we're not dealing with just TCDD, there's a family of chemicals. Every single one of us has some exposure. And a lot of the effects that we're beginning to understand, I should say in the past 10 years, are we're looking more broadly. Initially, the whole focus was on cancer. And as we began to look for other chronic diseases as well as developmental effects, we begin to see them. We're seeing some of the second generation effects, that if the mother is exposed, you can see effects in the offspring. And if the fathers were exposed, it appears to affect the number of baby boys born. So we need to remember that effects that are very hard to see in the individual, but you see in the population, and I probably don't have to say this to a public health audience, is that you know, effects are often called subclinical. Sometimes that means you don't know what to look for, and sometimes it means you really can see them only when you look at a population and see the shift in the distribution of the population, and that's what you see with lead. You can't look at Johnny and say, Johnny, gee, if you had a little less blood lead as a kid, you would have had a couple more IQ points. You have to look at the population. And again, the issues of altered sensitivity and susceptibility. So it seems to me that the public health position is that current levels in the environment are associated with levels in the general population, at least at the high end, which may be at or near the level where effects could be occurring. There's very little margin of exposure, so that we need to continue vigilance to reduce the sources and environmental levels, which will lead to decreased exposures. Thank you.
Yeah, we're running a few minutes behind, but since I'm the last speaker in this one, I can cut mine short. We have time for a few questions.
Yeah, Barry.
You mentioned the Cerveso data and breast
right.
cancer. Is there any other evidence for breast cancer?
The answer...
Begging the next question is, do you think there's anywhere near approaching sufficient evidence to say dioxins causally associated with breast cancer?
I'd say there's probably limited evidence. There is some animal data. Again, you have to have developmental exposure. If you expose adult animals, dioxin in the breast acts like an anti-estrogen. But if you expose animals, a number of animal species developmentally to dioxin, what you find is it totally alters the breast structure, making it much more susceptible to carcinogen insult. So you have the biological plausibility from the animal studies. The follow-up of the Seveso Women's Health Study, the report where they were able to, because they had the blood levels in the women and they could show a clear dose response, but it was only like 15 women as far as that had breast cancer at that time. That was the 96 follow-up. They're now analyzing the data for the 2006 follow-up. I'm hearing that it will strengthen the data. There are at least one or two cohorts where there were some industrial cohorts, where there were some women, and there was, in Manolis Kojovinas' cohort, he saw an increase in breast cancer in that cohort. What happened was in the first reports from Seveso, the first ecological studies, there was only one breast cancer, and they thought there maybe would have been two. That has not held up. So I think that... I could certainly make an argument that there is sufficient evidence, but limited, I don't think there's any question there's at least limited evidence. Yeah.
Could you speak a little more to the exposure to the food supply, both the animal and the plant component of it, and what are the sources of that now?
Okay. So plants are really not much of a source of dioxin exposure unless you were growing your plants on highly contaminated soil. And then if you don't wash your plants well, there could be some carryover of the dirt or the dust, okay? Dioxins are not taken up by the root system of plants very well at all. So it's primarily this whole issue that dioxins are very, very fat-loving chemicals. So if you get them into an animal at the bottom of the food chain, they're basically, because of their persistence, they will tend to magnify up the food chain. Human beings are at the top of a food chain, and unless you are a vegan, you are going to be getting your dioxins from fish, meat products, and dairy. And the levels today have come way down in our food from what they were 20 or 30 years ago. The major sources of dioxin today, the new sources, are primarily uncontrolled backyard burning and forest fires. Industry told us for years that forest fires were a major source. Well, 30 years later, they've got it right. Wasn't true in the past when we had all the other sources, the dioxins that were produced as contaminants of industrial processes. Those processes are controlled. So the major source of the food supply now would be... have to do with this biomagnification of the food chain. Some of it would be, for example, grazing animals on contaminated soils and then eating those animals. Steve?
Just a comment on that. Don't you also have fallout from emission sources as part of the
grain? Yeah. So some of the, for example, uncontrolled burning or stuff, you know, that'll emit. But the amount of additional dioxins that are being put into the environment today are tremendously lower than what was being done 20 or 30 years ago. So the way that our food may be, supplies may be getting contaminated is re-entrainment from highly contaminated soils, which are getting, you know, some of it's going to get picked up and spread around by the air, some of it is going to get by the product of animals actually grazing in it, if they're land animals, if they're, you know, if they're benthic animals in the oceans, for example, if you have highly contaminated sediment in rivers or lakes, and then coming up the food chain. Yeah. Okay, so there's been a lot of international regulation of dioxin, but clearly in the less developed world, you have lots of uncontrolled incineration and lots of uncontrolled combustion. But the products that unfortunately with contaminated dioxins, like some of the herbicides, like some of the biocides, like the chlorine bleaching of paper and pulp products, those things are pretty much not being done anywhere in the world anymore. Yeah. Well, I think part of it is that I don't think industry necessarily wants to do the bad thing. And when it's clear that there's a problem with a process, I think they look to move to something else. So that there's been a lot of voluntary compliance for some of the sources. There were actual bans. EPA actually banned some of the herbicides and pesticides and biocides that were highly contaminated. And then EPA controlled the new emissions from incineration by using a maximum achievable control technology. They didn't do it on a risk-based basis. They did it on a control technology basis.
Would you expect the fetuses in Nguyen in Vietnam today were affected by the dioxin that we dumped there in the 60s and 70s?
I mean, that is a very, very good question. The question, in case you didn't hear it, was what about children being born in Vietnam today? I mean, the levels of dioxins that were introduced into the environment in Vietnam were very large. Without having measurements of their exposure, without, for example, having the measures of what was in their mother, I don't think we can answer that question. There have been spot measurements of a relatively small number of people in Vietnam. We know where some of the hot spots are today. Some of them are not necessarily where it was sprayed, but maybe where it was stored. And in those populations, if someone wanted to take on doing some kind of epidemiological study, if you were to get the levels in the moms, which would basically have been transferred to the infant before they were born, and then also possibly lactationally, that might help you identify a population to look at.
When we have looked in Vietnam at people in the highly sprayed areas, it's been a very small number who've had elevated TCDD. For the most part throughout Vietnam, the TCDD dioxin levels are very low.
Okay, so the question is about the heritability and stuff and the genetic susceptibility. And the answer is, the good news is that the total number of people ever really highly exposed to dioxins is relatively small to the really high levels, which is what it takes to get chloracne. When I talked about the genetic polymorphism, that is based upon animal studies as well as humans, because if everybody was the same, you would expect at the same internal level that everyone would have the chloracne, and you don't see that. There's a very wide range in who gets it and who doesn't. So that implies, we do know that dioxin can cause epigenetic changes. We've seen that from, again, that's animal studies. We haven't yet looked in our human subjects to see if we can pick out some of those changes. Okay. Steve?
I have a comment. there was another force that was in their face that was an actress.
Right. This is Steve Lester of Center for Health and Environmental Justice, right? Making the comment about the importance of local action.
Well, my question is different. The question is about the cancer that dioxin causes. And there's been some thought, argument lately, that at high levels there's a different dose response than at low levels. Can you comment a little on that?
Sure. This is a general concern related to endocrine active chemicals, which is, and it actually makes perfect sense. The question is this was talked about in terms of cancer and dioxins, but also other things about you get different things happening at high and low doses. And the answer is absolutely, because at very low doses of exposure, you may get one effect. And then as you go to higher doses, that one effect, you don't see it because you totally overwhelm it with something else. Now, when you're looking at something like a cancer or even heart disease, there are many, many different pathways that you can take to get to that endpoint, okay? And so you might, for example, at a very low dose, have an effect, say, on body weight. And then at a high dose, you also cause that same, for example, decrease in body weight. At one point, it's due because you were doing something good, and another point is because you're overtly toxic. So I think the fact that dosage responses don't have to be linear, especially when you're dealing with the endocrine system. Other questions? Well, great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.